Hello and welcome for our computer graphics lecture. So we started last week with a very interesting problem, I would say, in computer graphics that is related to the rendering of textures. And just to remember what we were speaking about, so let's look at this simple example. It's an infinite plane or a very large plane. And we applied a texture which has this checkerboard pattern. Yeah, so that's very simple. We learned how to do that, how we have to we have to assign texture coordinates. Yeah, to know how this mapping happens. And here in the front area we are also fine. But now something interesting happens as soon as we go backwards, where we come to a region then where this original texture is minified. That means the texture, the single texels become smaller than a single pixel in the final image. Yeah, these checkerboards become so small that they become smaller than a single pixel, and then something very weird happens. Yeah, and almost random patterns appear if you animate this. So if you move around with a camera in that example. It is not that you have a slowly moving pattern, but this really, it starts flickering and it looks almost random. Okay, and now, yeah, that's an interesting problem. And so we looked at this a bit more, with a bit more detail. And of course, when thinking a little bit about it, it is clear that this problem must happen. So if we look at that example, for instance, so it's a kind of 2D version of that. So we look at a single scan line. The scan line has single pixels. So these are the pixels of the scan line. And during rendering, always the color at the center of these pixels is evaluated. Yeah. So the rendering happens by determining the color at the center of the single pixels. That's important, yeah? But that's how it typically happens. What scan line and whatever does, yeah, a fragment shader is evaluated at the center of a pixel and so on. Yeah? So that's the typical way that happens. And now we render this object here, yeah, onto this scan line. So here we are in the magnification in the near region. Yeah, so that would be an example. So the checkerboards now have colors. To be better able to interpret these results, but it's exactly this checkerboard example. Yeah, it's exactly here where we are in the magnification region. Yeah, so the single checkerboards are still significantly larger than a pixel, and now we look at that example and we see what happens here at this pixel. We get blue, blue, white, white, red, white, white, green, and we get this result. Yeah, and you can, of course, you can see that it's not the original. Yeah, so the red part is only half as big as the blue part. Yeah, but that's natural. Yeah, since we only do this. Sampling problems must appear, or we cannot completely describe this because we only have a finite resolution. Yeah, but nothing serious happens. of course, what will already happen here, if we move that a bit, yeah, to the side, then things will change. So suddenly this one will become 2 pixels wide and this one only 1 pixel. Yeah, so it's not perfect. But it's still sort of okay. Now the boundary case is when the texels are exactly as wide as the current scan line. In some sense, this is perfect because now we have a one-to-one mapping between the texture and the pixels, yeah, and we get a perfect reproduction of our texture. But that's a kind of lucky case, yeah? And if we get smaller now, what must happen is that with a sampling, certain pixels are skipped. Yeah? That's also, I think, easy to understand, yeah? now single pixels are skipped, and in particular with this checkerboard, now what happens is that, so if we are in the range that the texels are about only half the size of the pixels, then every second texel is skipped, and as a result for the checkerboard, you get a complete white line. Yeah? If your texels are only half as large as a pixel, you always skip every second pixel and you get a complete white line. And if the checkerboard moves a little bit, yeah, suddenly you're not on the even positions but on the odd positions, and suddenly this entire line becomes black. Yeah? And this region can also be found probably somewhere here. Okay, it's not that well visible. I would guess it happens somewhere here. I'm not really sure about that. Yeah? But nevertheless, I think you understand, or it's well understandable what's going on here. Okay, so yeah, this obviously is a problem. You might say, okay, it's a problem. So we have to live with that. But yeah, in fact, this problem can be understood and it can be analyzed, and there are simple means to cope with that. And in fact, it's also just another instance of the aliasing problem. We already spoke about that when doing rasterization. These jaggies, these staircases in rasterization, they are also an aliasing problem. And I showed you ways, for instance, for the Bresenham to get anti-aliasing by not only setting pixels to black and white, but also to use in-between colors. That's kind of smears boundaries and makes them less visible. And yeah, this texture effect that we see here is also a way, a problem of aliasing. But in fact, for textures, it's better solvable. And essentially, one could say it can be solved, and it's completely understood. Okay, so let's have a deeper look into that. And the nice thing is that this aliasing problem, as I described it here, can be very well be described mathematically. And it's a well-known problem also from other areas, from signal analysis. And yeah, but as so often in computer graphics, we have the advantage that we have a very visual way to look at these things, yeah, and maybe to understand these things easily. So what we will do in the following is that we take an image like this one, or like this one, doesn't matter, and we look at a single scan line of such an image. Yeah. So for now, we only look at single lines. Of course, an image is 2D. Yeah. But looking at a line is sufficient. Yeah. We don't need to go further for our problem. And then we look at the intensities values, and what we get is something like this. So here we see this is a rendered image, so we have very sharp boundaries from black to this triangle. This is brighter. Then we have this very thin line that's a little peak. Then this thin object and this object. Yeah. So this is the intensity along a single scan line. And for a photograph, yeah, this is much more noisy, has much more detail. So that's this line of this photograph here. And now we consider this one as a signal. Yeah, you can imagine a sound signal or whatever you prefer. Yeah, so it's just a signal. This is time, and along time we have this signal. Yeah. Okay. So now we have this signal here. This is the signal of the original image. Yeah. So imagine you look with your camera into the real world. And there, a single scan line is a continuous signal. Yeah? And what we do now, if we map this to pixels, is that we sample this signal. From this signal here, we take values with fixed step size. Yeah? So every pixel, we measure this signal. So what we get is something like this here. This is this original signal. And now we sampled it at every pixel. Yeah? So that's kind of shown here. I mean, this is already an image. So imagine this is the real world. And now we take a rather coarse sampling. And these are the single samples where we sample the signal. Yeah? So what we have is not the continuous signal, but these single sampled values. And now, this is what we store in the computer, yeah, using an array. And now from this, we somehow reconstruct, again, a continuous signal. This reconstruction typically happens on the screen. Yeah, you send to the screen this array of values, these here, or write them to the frame buffer. And then on the screen, what you get back is an image like that. And here, all these values are, again, sort of interpolated, yeah, to give you a continuous impression again. And of course, now, ideally, this signal and this signal, they should be the same. But it's clear, yeah, that it cannot be always the case. Yeah? For very simple cases, this is possible. But as soon as there's more detail than can be stored in these coefficients here, in these numbers here, then the reconstruction must be different. Okay, good. So if we want to look closer, or look closer at that, of course, the critical point is the sampling part here, yeah, because from here to here, information must get lost. Yeah? And so we are handling sampling problems or facing sampling problems. And as I said, this we already saw such problems. And one of these problems is for rasterization. If we have, yeah, very small objects, for instance, or just along edges of polygons, we see these staircases. And another instance of that problem is that if we have very little triangles, then sampling might simply miss these objects. Yeah? If you take this triangle and you try to rasterize it, what will happen is that all these samples are outside the triangle, and you see no triangle at all. And the other triangle, this one, is exactly as big as that one, but it happens to lie on the samples. So this one will become very visible. Yeah, these pixels are rather big. They will all be set. And this will be visible in 3 pixels and this in none. And for smaller triangles, the same thing happens. No? And now you might say, OK, these small triangles, I mean, they are so tiny. Yeah, do we really have to worry? And yes, you have. So 3D graphics is so powerful today that the scenes are typically so big that you have many of these triangles that are almost only pixel size or maybe even much smaller. Yeah? OK, so that's one instance of the sampling problem. And yeah, we saw a first solution for that for the Brazenham using anti-aliasing. And yeah, there are, for this small triangle problem, there are other solutions that could be used here. OK, but we won't go into detail for this. But we will now look at the problem in connection with texture. With textures, yeah, because here it's also a sampling problem. Yeah, here in this, if we look at these lines, for instance, yeah, in particular here, what you see is suddenly that new frequencies appear. Yeah, it looks like there is a stripe pattern with new stripes that are wider than the original ones, yeah, but these stripes are nowhere in the original texture. These patterns happen due to weird effects that we want to try to understand now. This effect is also called aliasing. And yeah, it's not very difficult to understand where they come from if you use the right machinery. Let's take the following example. So let's say this here is our texture signal, yeah? And instead of a checkerboard, we now take a sine wave. We will see later on why a sine wave makes sense, because we will come back to Fourier analysis. So let's say our original signal is the sine wave. And now we sample the sine wave at these positions, here, 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 and here. And you can imagine now the sampling density is very well chosen. Yeah? It's so chosen that we always hit here the sign at the maximum and at the minimum. Yeah, that's sort of the minimum sampling that is needed to catch this oscillating behavior. Yeah? If we further increase the sample density, that means if we... that comes later. So that's kind of optimal case. But now let's assume we just move the sine wave a little bit, or we move the samples a little bit. What will happen now is that we don't hit the wave at the maximum and at the minimum, but much closer to the zero. Yeah? That's exactly the same sampling distance, but now we don't hit maximum and minimum, but a bit off. And what we get is a sine wave that has, if we only look at these samples, the only reasonable thing we can reconstruct is a sine wave that has much smaller amplitude. Yeah? But the frequency is still the same. Yeah? So we get a checkerboard that has where the black and white fields are not black and white, but some more grayish, but the size of the squares is still the same. And we may also be unlucky that we always sample at the zero point and then we get no signal at all. Yeah, but this is a real, you really need bad luck to directly get this part. Okay, yeah, so that kind of is sort of still okay, but now what happens if we further increase the frequency of our sine wave? Yeah. Now we still have the same sampling pattern, but now we take a sine wave with higher frequency. Yeah? And now you see, we get the first sample here, and the next maximum and minimum are skipped, and we immediately hit one maximum later. Then we end up here, the next one here, the next one here, 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 and here. And now if you don't know this original curve, but only these samples, what you would assume that the original signal was is this sine curve here. Yeah? So you see this regular original pattern sampled with too large distance again leads to values that could lie on a sine curve, but a sine curve with lower frequency. Yeah? And this is in fact happens what happens here in this region, for instance. Yeah? So the checkerboard is much finer, and you sample it in large steps, and what you see is now a checkerboard with a different frequency. Yeah? So a typical example would be if you have this case, your checkerboard looks like this, and your sampling frequency looks like this, that you have so that's black, white, black, white, black, white. And your sampling always goes three steps further. So you get black, white, then black again. And then three further, you get white again, and so forth. So suddenly you see a checkerboard, yeah, that has two times as large squares. Yeah, twice as large squares. And of course, you can continue that, yeah, if you always go five further and so on. Okay, yeah, so that's an unpleasant effect. And it can really result in very weird behavior. So another example here is a signal that is again a sine wave, but now with increasing frequency. Yeah, so the frequency, the distance between the maxima and the minima becomes smaller and smaller. So this is the original signal here. And now if we sample that signal in a certain distance, at some point we run into trouble. Yeah, and then we get this here and we get this pattern out. Yeah, and here on this side we really get almost random behavior. And that looks very unstable and so on. Yeah. Okay, so how can we further analyze this? And I already said so. We have to apply a Fourier analysis to understand that. And so don't worry, we don't need formula for now. We really just need some intuition and some understanding to understand this effect. So the idea of Fourier analysis is quite simple. So each of these signals, or I think I have another one here. Yeah, so we can take an arbitrary signal like this one here, and Fourier analysis tells us that we can represent this as just the addition of a large number of sine waves. Yeah? So we take sine waves like this one, or this one, or this one. You see it's always has always increasing frequency, and at the same time, also the amplitude gets smaller. Yeah, so we take these sine waves, and if we add these, yeah, suddenly we get a signal that doesn't look like it is originally sine waves. In that case, it's a checkerboard. Yeah, and in fact, you can do that for any signal. For any signal, you can decompose that into such a number of sine waves and just add these together. Yeah? And even such things like this checkerboard can be constructed from that. Okay, so that's a very, very rough description of the idea of Fourier analysis. Of course, the problem is now, given such a signal, how can I compute these coefficients and these frequencies and stuff like that? We don't need to go into detail for that, and probably already heard that in other lectures or will hear in other lectures. Yeah, but the important thing is everything is such an addition of sine waves. Here another example. Yeah, we have this original or this signal, and this can be described as an addition of different waves. And here on the right, you always see so the first sine wave is this one, and this gives us this. And this is already a very rough approximation of this curve. Now we add higher detail, this gives us this one. Even higher detail gives us this one. So this one is already has some similarity with the final signal. And then we add more and more detail. It's a bit like this turbulence thing, if you remember from procedural texture generation. OK, good. Now, the next OK, now the idea of Fourier analysis is that we describe, or that with this derivation here, we have two different ways to describe such a signal. So the first one, we can describe it like such a curve here. Yeah, that's really the signal over time, or in our case, over pixels. But the other way, we can also describe it in frequency space. That means we here on the right, we see a kind of histogram of these single curves that needed to be added to get this curve here. And here in this description here on the right, so if we take this signal, this is the original signal, yeah, it would be such a checkerboard here. And you remember from that image, no, from that one, we can construct such a signal by adding these sine waves. Yeah, so we take sines with increasing frequency. So here frequency is 1, here it's 3, 5, 7, 9, and so on, and decreasing amplitude. The amplitude here is 1, 1 over 3, 1 over 5, 1 over 7, 1 over 9. Yeah? So we have sine waves with increasing frequency and decreasing amplitude. And this is plotted here. So if you just look at the right half, you see, yeah, we have one sine wave with minimum frequency, and then the frequency increases. Each of these lines here is a single sine wave, yeah, and the frequency of these sine waves increases, and the amplitude also decreases. So from on this axis, we have frequency of the sine waves, and here we have amplitude. Yeah, and this is just a sum of different sine waves. That's why we have these peaks here. But for a more random signal like this here, yeah, we can directly transform this, or Fourier analysis transforms this to such a diagram. Okay, for mathematical reasons, these diagrams also have a negative range, yeah. So, but it's always symmetric. So here on the left side, we have this is just a mirrored version of the right side, it's just for mathematical reasons that we have this symmetry here. Yeah, but they always look the same left and right. So this diagram tells us that this signal, it tells us which frequencies are part of that signal. And you see some peaks here, so that's sort of main frequencies or high frequencies that appear here. So you could imagine the step from here to here corresponds, or what I found intuitive is that this is an audio signal. This is something that we record with a microphone. And this tells us just the notes from which this tone here is generated. Yeah, it tells you the main frequencies that appear here. And if you play an A on the piano, you get such a signal, which is definitely not a sine wave, yeah, unless you have a very cheap piano. This is definitely not a sine wave, so it has other frequencies in it. And here in this diagram, there should be a clear peak around the A, around the frequency for the A, but there are other frequencies next to it. Yeah, and this makes the special sound of your particular piano or guitar or whatever you have. Yeah? And also for this checkerboard, for instance, here. Yeah, what? Okay, so that's not. Oh, okay, well, let's maybe take this here. This is another extreme example. Here you really have one single sine wave. Yeah, and what you get is this clear peak. Yeah. So it's really a spike here, and it says, okay, this entire signal consists of one sine wave with this frequency here. That's exactly the frequency of this wave. This peak here is the sine wave with frequency zero, and that's just a constant, yeah, because the sine wave does not oscillate around zero, but around 0.5. This generates this peak here, and this is the real sine wave. Okay, good, yeah? So, very simple introduction to what we will need in the following, but it's enough. Okay, now there is an interesting theorem that probably most of you heard, I think so. If not, it's not a problem. And that's the theorem of Nyquist and Shannon. And this one says, if you have such a signal and you sample it with a certain frequency or with a certain distance, yeah, you sample this distance every certain time step, then the reconstruction is only possible. And I mean, reconstruction is exactly what we want, yeah? If I go back, sorry, I know I shouldn't do that, but yeah, that means we have this signal, now we sample it, and we reconstruct it. And now this theorem says this signal can only be the same one as the original signal, yeah? This reconstruction can only be the original one if the frequency with which we sample, yeah, is at least twice as high as the highest frequency in the signal. That means if we take our signal and we do this Fourier analysis, yeah, then we get frequencies, and ideally at some point, yeah, this diagram here drops to zero. Yeah? So we only have frequencies up or sine waves up to a certain frequency. And if this is the case, so if we can cut off this diagram here at some point, and we know there are no frequencies beyond that. From this frequency, we can derive how finely we have to sample the original signal to get a faithful reconstruction. Or, if this is the case, then with a fixed sampling at a certain frequency, we can reconstruct the original signal. If there is arbitrary fine detail, yeah, then we won't be able to do anything anyhow. But if we can cut off here at some point, we can get a good reconstruction. And this we will derive now in the following, and in fact, it's not very complicated. So let's again look at this texture signal. Yeah, so this is a pattern, it's a line of this monkey image. Now if we look at the Fourier spectrum, so this diagram is called the Fourier spectrum of the signal, we see this result. Yeah, so we have a peak here in the middle, that's the kind of average of the signal, and then we see here certain frequencies that appear in this image. And what we see, at some point here it drops off to zero, but that's not important for now. Okay, now we sample this signal. That means, we take a value of that signal at a certain step size. Yeah, and this sampling we describe by multiplying this signal with this sample pattern. Yeah, so that's a sample pattern that is one at the sample points and zero otherwise. Yeah, it's a bit of a weird function, but we multiply this one with this one, and then we get the sample at, or the product, yeah, at these sample positions gives us the function value of the texture signal. Yeah, so that's okay. I won't go back again. Good. So now the nice thing is, it is known that in image and in frequency space, or certain operations in image space, we can map to certain operations in frequency space. That means, and one of these things that we know is the following: if we multiply two functions in image space, yeah, what we do here, we have our original signal, and we multiply that with a sample pattern. Multiplication in image space is, convolution, and I will come back to what convolution is, in frequency space. That means, in order to multiply these two, or if we multiply these two, we get this result here in image space. And in frequency space, we can take the spectrum of this signal, that's this one. Then we take the spectrum of this signal, this weird signal here, and this again is such a comp function, but with another frequency. I will also come back to this. Yeah. So in frequency space, this one looks like this. And now the multiplication from here, this times this gives this, is a convolution in frequency space. This convolved with this function gives this function. Okay, so what's a convolution? And this can be well described here with this image, I would say. For such comp functions here, a convolution simply means take the original signal here and place it at every spike of this function. Yeah? So this convolution just takes many copies of this signal and adds them together. Yeah? At every spike of this function here is positioned, and they are all added together. In fact, the convolution is a bit more complicated, but in this case, we don't need that. It's for that particular case, it works like this. Yeah? So this function is taken and then positioned at exactly the distance that is provided by this function. Yeah? Okay, so the Fourier spectrum of this one is this one here. Yeah? Okay. And now something interesting also happens, and that's the following. The smaller the distance on this side here is, that means the finer the sampling that we do in image space, the smaller our pixels are, essentially, the higher the resolution, the larger the distance here on this side becomes. Yeah? So if I make this denser, if I increase pixel resolution, then these spikes here get further apart. So what will happen here is that just these copies also get further apart. Yeah? And okay. Good. Yeah, this again now is the slide to this convolution thing. Yeah, so what we observed now is the following. We have this texture signal. This signal has this frequency or this spectrum. And now we sample it, and as a result, we get this spectrum. So this, in fact, is the definition of a convolution or of a folding. And for that particular case with these single spikes, it's really just adding these copies. Now the finer we do the sampling here, so if we take smaller pixels, then this one, the distance between these one would become larger. Okay, and now, or if I go back to that one, now we can also maybe guess what a problem will be. Let's assume, or if we sample this signal, we get in frequency space this result here. And what you can see is that we have many copies of that one, and these copies overlap here. Yeah? What we do if we have this signal here, and we reconstruct it. From here, we want to get back to this signal here. Yeah? What we could do is that we say, OK, we even know the sampling frequency, so I isolate one of these peaks. Yeah? I isolate this by just cutting off all the others on the right and on the left. And then I do an inverse Fourier analysis. Yeah? I transform this one back to image space, and then I hopefully have this texture signal. This will function, or this will work, if these single spikes can clearly be separated again. Yeah? If I can really cut off here and here, and then go from here to here back, then I'm fine. But unfortunately, you see that there is frequency content that is so large that two neighboring such spikes will overlap. So if I just cut off here, I will still here see frequencies that come from the left spike. Yeah? And the same on the right. Yeah? If I cut off here, I still see frequencies from the right spike. And if these frequencies here go even further, then this overlap will be much larger. Yeah? Then at this spike or in this range, I also see frequencies from this or from this and so forth. Yeah? And these are exactly these frequencies that annoy us. This is exactly these frequencies that happen, for instance, here. Yeah? So I take an original signal, and I sample it at too high a frequency, and then I get this lower frequency. And this is exactly such a problem. Yeah? We have a high frequency function, and due to sampling, it generates an overlap, and it suddenly generates a frequency that we would interpret as this one. Yeah? So the high frequency is somewhere here. And if we add them together, this frequency of this part here comes to a frequency that is here much lower. Yeah? And that's what's called aliasing. Aliasing means you see something different. Yeah, you see a difference, a frequency that was not there in the original image. Yeah, you see another frequency. Okay. So, that's a quite, it's not simple, but at least I hope the intuition becomes a little bit clear that it's a good way to understand what is going on. Yeah, how do these strange patterns appear? Where do they come from? And now the question, of course, is, what could we do against that? And let's look at that example again. This is, again, it is a very similar picture. Yeah, the original signal let's say, has this spectrum, yeah? And now we do a sampling, a coarse sampling, and in frequency space, we add copies next to each other, and what happens now is that here we have an overlap, yeah? And this overlap will lead to these aliasing problems, and if we do a finer sampling, that means our comb on the left gets finer, then the frequency spectrum on the right, the comb gets wider, so these copies are get further apart, and now you see here we have a clear separation, and looking at this signal, if we have this one, we can simply reconstruct the original signal just by cutting off here, yeah, and we are fine. Yeah, so here with this sampling density, we can do a complete reconstruction. With this sample density, we cannot do a complete reconstruction. Okay, now you might say, that's not really a solution. Yeah? Now we understand, given a particular texture, for instance, yeah, how fine does the screen resolution have to be so that we see no aliasing? But of course, we cannot change screen resolution as needed. Yeah? It's increasing, but nevertheless, there will always be a limit. Yeah? So screen resolution is given. We have to live with a certain screenless resolution. That means we cannot increase the sampling as we wish. So what we have to do is that we kind of have to work on the original signal. Yeah? We have to look at that original signal, and we have to say, okay, there are frequencies in this original signal that lead to problems, and these frequencies are also so fine that we cannot represent it on our screen anyhow. Yeah? It's like this checkerboard. If you have little squares on your checkerboard that are smaller than a single pixel, yeah, you won't be able to show these single squares. Yeah? You have no chance. You cannot show things that are beyond the resolution of your screen. So before they generate problems, and they suddenly reappear as new frequencies, yeah, and generate aliasing, we get rid of them before we sample them. That means we take this original signal, we have to take this original signal, and just have to cut off all frequencies, yeah, that are below the rate that we can display, or above the rate we can display. Yeah? And the width of this here, the width of this box is exactly given by the sampling, by the spacing of our samples. Yeah? So we can transfer or transform our screen resolution, our pixel distance. Yeah? We can immediately transform this to a frequency and can say from our original signal, we can only display the content up to a certain frequency. And everything beyond that frequency should be thrown away. Essentially, for the checkerboard, what that would mean, if I go back, maybe, where's the checkerboard? Here it is. Yeah. Essentially, that means, for instance, if it said that everything beyond here has to be cut, that we have to replace our checkerboard by something like this, yeah, which is more sine wave-like, yeah, or let's say we have to cut off here. Then we represent our checkerboard with a sine wave, and if we are even beyond the sine wave, we have to cut off the sine wave, and all that remains, yeah, is no oscillation. That means we have to replace our checkerboard just with a gray plane. Yeah, it becomes just the average. And in that example, that would mean from here on, where aliasing problems start, we have to replace our checkerboard here just with gray. Yeah? And that maybe sounds a little bit surprising. At least some people are surprised if I ask in the exam about that. But in fact, that's the best that you can do. Yeah? You have black and white squares. They are smaller than a single pixel. So the best you can do how to represent them is by a grayish plane. Yeah? Okay, Good. So we have to take the original signal and cut off everything beyond that frequency that we cannot display anyhow. And if we do so, yeah, now imagine we take the original signal, then we cut off all these frequencies. Also going back to this image, yeah. So if you imagine we cut off beyond this frequency, that means instead of taking this signal, we only take this signal. And if you compare these two, you see that they are similar, but this is a kind of filtered or blurred version of this one. Yeah, it's all the higher detail is just filtered away, and you get a more smooth representation. Yeah, and this one now still can be reconstructed without aliasing, but this one could not. So we have to take the original signal, filter out all frequencies that we cannot display, get something like this here, and this is essentially a blurring. Yeah, so we have to take a filtered, a blurred version of our texture, and we have to blur it so much that we can still display it. Yeah, that's where we want to end up. And so the result will look like this. Now again, in a larger overview, we have our signal, and this is the spectrum. Okay, and now we filter out all frequencies that we cannot display anyhow. Yeah, all these little spikes or all these little waves here, yeah, they are beyond pixel resolution. So they will be filtered out. We will see later on how to do that. Then we get this filtered signal. Yeah, it's still very similar to that one, but you see that little detail is canceled, like this one here is completely canceled out. Yeah, also here, that's all filtered away. In frequency space, this looks like this. Yeah, this is exactly like this one, but here all frequencies beyond this part here are filtered away. Yeah? Now we have a much more narrow frequency spectrum, and now we can sample. This gives us this here, and the sampling in frequency space means generating all these copies, and you see that this cutoff here is chosen such that these copies exactly don't overlap. Yeah? Exactly those parts that would generate overlap have been thrown away. So now we have this here. Now we can again filter out that middle one. Yeah? And we get this here. And this is exactly the same as this. And this we can reconstruct. Yeah? So we cannot reconstruct this signal, but this filtered version here. This can be faithfully reconstructed. From here to here, this can be done without loss. Okay. Good. Two more things. This part here, this filtering filtering with this function here, in frequency space, this is essentially a multiplication with such a box function. Yeah, it's just a function that is one in this frequency range that we are allowed to use and zero outside. Yeah? Going from here to here is a multiplication with such a box function. Now we have to do the same what we did here, multiplication in frequency space means convolution in image space. It also works the other way around. And such a box function in frequency space, in image space, corresponds to a sinc function. A sinc is nothing else but sine x over x. So it's a sine. It's a sine function that has an amplitude that becomes smaller and smaller. It looks like this. And So this reconstruction here, yeah, going from here to here, means convolution with this sinc function. So that means at every peak here, we again have to multiply such a sinc here. And that's also a little bit surprising. The domain of the sinc function is infinite. Yeah? So it has, you can go as far as you wish. Yeah? If the values become smaller, but they still contribute. That means for the reconstruction at this position here, the value of the very first pixel still has an influence. Yeah? But yeah, that's what theory says and what can also be reconstructed. And what generates reasonable results, yeah? So this reconstruction step from here to here assumes that you apply such a sinc function. Now I said this reconstruction here doesn't happen by convolution or whatever. This is what your screen does, yeah? Essentially, your screen takes these pixel values, yeah? And it takes this one to set pixel 1, the second one to set pixel 2, and so forth. So essentially, in an idealized world, it would not make a convolution with this one, but a convolution with this function that is just, yeah, one where the pixel is set and zero outside the pixel. Yeah? But of course, normally, TFTs or whatever type of screen you have do not have such a sharp function. It might be a little bit blurrier, something like this. Yeah, but it still it has about roughly similar shape like the sinc function, but it's still different. Yeah, so the reconstruction that a screen does is not the perfect sort of perfect reconstruction here. But nevertheless, the theory is still valid. Yeah, we can, and the major part of that theory is that before sampling, we have to filter out all frequencies beyond that one. Yeah, that's still the important message. And so there's still, from time to time, we can still read discussions, or it's kind of accepted that even if in theory the sinc function in is the theoretical best one to reconstruct, even if you use that to do reconstruction not only on the screen but for other purposes where you can apply arbitrary reconstruction, people don't use the sinc function, but some more Gaussian-like functions, yeah, because they generate less artifacts. The sinc function generates over swings and so on. So it's not really perfect. It's more a theoretical construct. Okay, but good. I don't want to deviate too much. Yeah, so don't worry about that. This one here is done by the screen, and the important part is that we avoid aliasing by getting here an input signal that only has frequencies that can be or that avoid aliasing. Yeah? So we have to cut off these frequencies. That's the important part. Okay. Good. Yeah. So we have to avoid frequencies beyond this Nyquist frequency. And yeah, now if we go back to our texture problem, what does that mean? Our sampling frequency, yeah, should be higher than the texture frequency. That means, or put it the other way around, yeah, if we look at the or if our texture is displayed in a way such that the sampling frequency, yeah, that's the frequency of our pixel grid. Yeah? And if this becomes smaller than the texel frequency, that's exactly the example that I showed in the very beginning, yeah, then we get aliasing. Okay? Yeah, that's what we already learned in the very first image. Yeah, so how could we solve that? Yeah, how could we find a solution for that? And of course, it's not really a solution to do that filtering step kind of during texturing. Yeah, that would be very, very complex, and for every pixel we would have to do a complete filtering operation on our image and so on. That's not really a solution. But in fact, there's a very nice and elegant solution to sort of push that to a pre-processing step, that filtering. And what comes out is what we call MIP mapping. And here the idea is the following. So let's assume we have this texture here. Yeah. And now we look at that texture from a certain distance, and we are still in the magnification range. So our sampling frequency, our pixel frequency, is higher than the texel frequency. Yeah. So the texels are still enlarged on the screen. Now we go further away, and at some point we have a one-to-one mapping. Yeah. Now we have the range where exactly every pixel of the texture maps to a pixel on the screen. And now if we go further away, we come into the aliasing range. Yeah? Now we are in the trouble range. And we simply solve that by switching to another texture. Yeah? And this texture now is a smaller one. It's a kind of down-filtered version of that original one. It's just a smaller texture showing exactly the same image. Yeah? But since this texture now only has half the pixels in width and height, suddenly the texel frequency is halved. Yeah? So now the texels are become twice as big, and we are again in the OK range. Yeah? And if we move further away, at some point, again, even this texture has too high resolution. Yeah? And then again, we switch to another texture, to an even smaller one, and so forth, until we end up with a texture that is only one pixel wide. And now this filtering process that I described, cut off all frequencies beyond Nyquist, this essentially happened by filtering that texture down to this size, yeah, by shrinking the size of the texture. When we replace this texture by this one, yeah, this texture obviously or has less pixels, so obviously it can contain less frequencies, it contains less detail. And now the idea is that this contains less detail or less higher frequencies than this one, in such a way that here now aliasing is reduced up to the moment that texels are again as small as pixels, and then we have to go back to this texture and so forth. So for the checkerboard example, what that means is the following. So let's assume we have a 4x4 texture. And this looks like this. So this is our input texture. Yeah, it's not a complete checkerboard, it's only 2x2 squares. And now we do a down filtering, that means we replace that by a 2x2 texture. Yeah, we want to replace this one by a 2x2 texture. Yeah, so how can we do that? So the typical way is that we say, okay, this pixel corresponds to these four pixels from the input image. Yeah? So we just take the average of these four. So this one becomes white again, this one remains black, this one black, and this one becomes white again. Yeah, so that's simple. Yeah, it's just, I mean, yeah, it's essentially here we have too fine a resolution, this contains the same information. But in the next step, we have to replace this by a 1x1 texture, and this is again the average of these four, and what we get is gray. Yeah. So at some point in this pyramid here, so if we start with a real 8x8 checkerboard, for instance, somewhere here in the pyramid, suddenly our checkerboard becomes such a gray area. And if we go back to that infinite plane with a checkerboard on it, that means we see the single squares, and as soon as these squares become smaller than the screen pixels, yeah, we switch to gray. Yeah, we fade to gray. And but as I said, yeah, this is exactly the effect that we want. And yeah, so this fits very nice. Yeah, it, if if we argument in terms of frequency of the signals and so on, what we do here is exactly this idea. Yeah, by using lower resolution, we cut off higher frequencies here. I mean, it's not perfectly right, but this is mainly to help understanding a little bit. Yeah, by decreasing resolution, we make this width of the spectrum smaller and smaller. And by this, yeah, we can avoid aliasing if these peaks get narrower and narrower, closer together. Yeah, we need a narrower and narrower frequency spectrum here to be able to still do the reconstruction. Okay. Good. Yeah, so this MIP mapping is a very nice, useful feature. It is supported by every graphics hardware or whatever, every renderer, be it offline, online, real-time, whatever, typically uses MIP mapping. And yeah, it's an automated procedure. Typically, you just provide the texture in the highest resolution, and then the first thing that should be done is generating a MIP map of that. In OpenGL, for instance, it is directly supported that for every texture, you do not only have the highest resolution version, but immediately generate such a text stack of textures. And there's one very nice feature exploited. And that's the following. If you imagine, that's a typical assumption of OpenGL that you probably also already realized, that the width and the height of these textures should also always be powers of two. Now let's assume it's even a square. And so our texture is a power of two square, and you have R, G, and B. Yeah? So what you can do is that you generate an image, a black and white image, where the red channel is contained in the upper left, the green channel in the upper right, the blue channel in the lower left, yeah? And then there's one square left. And in this one square, you can now store the finer resolutions of the MIP map. Yeah? You can again subdivide this to 4, and then here R is stored, here G, and then here B. Yeah, so this is sort of MIP map level 1. This is MIP map level 0. And then here again, yeah, you have R, G, B of MIP map level 2, and so forth. Yeah, so everything in the end again ends up in a square image, and this entire MIP map hierarchy is stored in such an image. But you don't have to care about that. you just have to compute these intermediate images. There are also methods available to do that automatically. But if you want to, you can also define your own ways to define these intermediate steps. Then all these textures are uploaded. And then, of course, you need to tell OpenGL to use this MIP map stack here. And okay, now we are still facing the problem that if we want to compute the texture for a particular point, yeah, we have to find out which of these levels here is to be used, yeah, and to apply the right level. And in fact, OpenGL, for instance, does this for you. It automatically computes the right MIP map level, which is, yeah, it requires some computation, but it's still doable. And then, in fact, what it also does, it does not compute a particular level. It does not say level 0, 1, 2, or 3 or so, but it computes a fractional level. It computes a value like 1.7. Yeah, that means level 1 is a little bit too fine, yeah, and level 2 is not fine enough yet, or just not fine enough. And then there's automatically this texture is evaluated at the right position and this one, and then according to this value 1.7, there's a third interpolation done in that dimension. So we have a trilinear interpolation. That means at the texture position, yeah, two succeeding textures of the hierarchy are red. So if we are just between this level and this level, for instance, here the texture is evaluated, this texture is evaluated here, this texture is evaluated here, and then the two values are interpolated, yeah, using the value that tells us the MIPMAP level. Yeah, so we have a trilinear interpolation. And by this, it's avoided that there's a clear transition from this hierarchy level to this hierarchy level. So in yeah, for the checkerboard example, that would mean, I think there's, yeah. For the checkerboard example, that would mean, so this is with MIP mapping, by the way. Yeah, so you see in the background, things become completely gray. And if we would not use trilinear interpolation, then at some point here, we would have, further here, we would have an abrupt transition to gray. Yeah, and this gives a clear visible border. But with trilinear interpolation, this is kind of blurred out. Yeah, and this is the result with MIP mapping, and this is without MIP mapping. And you see here, the textures are a bit sharper. Yeah, but here in the background, it's completely broken. Yeah, and this is completely avoided here. Yeah, and this is again this trilinear interpolation. Yeah, evaluate texture n here and texture n plus 1 here, and then do the final interpolation here. Okay, good. So, that's again a little summary. As a final remark on OpenGL, you explicitly have to turn on MIP mapping, tell OpenGL, okay, yes, I want to MIP mapping, and this is combined with a function to define whether you want bilinear interpolation within a texture or nearest neighbor. We also spoke about that. Yeah, and these are the different constants. And for instance, this one here means this one is the most stupid one. Let's say this one. This means for the MIP map, always take the nearest one. So don't use this trilinear interpolation. And within the single textures, do linear interpolation. And this one is the highest quality. This does linear interpolation within the texture and linear interpolation within the MIP map. Yeah? So that's real 3D or trilinear filtering. And this one is always taking nearest neighbors. Okay, good. So much on texture aliasing and anti-aliasing. That's the more important part. Are there any questions on this? Okay, so who heard about aliasing in signals before in any other lectures? Okay, so it makes sense to explain that again, right? Who heard about Fourier analysis before? Also not everybody. Okay, good. So if there are no further questions, I would like to continue with more soft stuff. Okay. Oops. Screen is full. Okay. So up to now, we were always applying images to our objects. So we were just gluing some images onto them. Yeah, a checkerboard on a plane. Or bricks onto a wall or something like that. But in the introduction, I already mentioned that texturing can be used for more. Yeah? There are more effects that you can generate with textures by adding spatial information onto your objects. And yeah, I just want to give you a brief overview of what is also possible with textures here. So if you're interested in such stuff, I recommend to visit the lecture Interactive Computer Graphics. For instance, there we speak a lot about textures and what you can do beyond gluing images onto objects. And this is a kind of sneak preview to what we will do there. So for instance, that's you know this example, and even if it's very dark, you can imagine that's a very simple scene, geometrically very simple. And now we apply these images that we directly glue on these textures, that we just use to modulate the color. But of course, and I also mentioned that, you can take the information from textures to control other parameters or any parameter of your lighting model. Yeah? You can take a color texture and use it to only or to store the specular coefficient of your Phong model. Yeah? Or you can take a black and white texture, for instance. Yeah, this is a one-channel texture, and can use that as the Phong Phong exponent of your model. Yeah, so what happens here? So this is obviously a map of the Earth, and all pixels in the oceans are white, and where there's Earth, it's black. And now this here, these values are taken as the Phong exponent of the normal Phong lighting model. And as a result, it's also a bit dark, please excuse that, but what you see is that everything where there's C becomes very specular. Yeah, that's how we are used to perceive water, it's very specular. And on the Earth is completely diffuse. Yeah, so that's a very simple alternative. It can also be used, or it's typically used, to describe wet roads, where the same trick is used to store how wet is this part of the road in this in a texture, and then your shader takes this information to apply different models, depending on whether it's wet or not, or stuff like that. Yeah, you can imagine millions of different things. Of course, it's also possible to store more than one texture, if you want to store the diffuse component and maybe some exponent and other information, then you can apply several textures and let it be with three channels or with one channel or with two channels. They are all possibilities. Okay. But a particularly interesting and widely used approach goes even a little bit further. And here the idea is the following. We can apply a texture to an object, and in the texture we do not store color information, but instead we store normal information in that texture. So the result or the idea is maybe depicted here. So let's assume you have this object that you want to represent. And since it is curved, you need lots of triangles for that. Okay? So a simple way to achieve that is to do the following. You replace this surface by a flat triangle, by a single flat triangle, and we apply a texture, and this texture stores normals, and these normals are the normals of this object. Yeah? So you see this curved shape here? This is this shape. Yeah? So, okay, now when doing the lighting computations, if we light this point here, we do not take the normal that we get by interpolation, but instead we read our texture, and we interpret that value as a normal, and we use this normal for lighting computation. And as you will see let's look at this example here. Of course, this is exaggerated. That's too big a mountain. That's just geometrically very different from that one. But for this Earth example here, what you can do is that you add a texture. This texture contains normal information of the real surface of the Earth. And when rendering, this normal is taken for lighting. And now you can see here, for instance, yeah, you can see this highlight. This is just due to the normals that are stored here, but the geometry is still a rather coarsely tessellated sphere. Yeah, you have rather large triangles, so these triangles are much larger than this detail here, and this highlight only happens from the texture, from the normals in the texture. Yeah, and here, even here, it's much more apparent. And now for this example, it's also not a problem that here the geometry is very different from this one, yeah? But here the difference is relatively small compared to the Earth. Yeah? The tallest mountains is 8 kilometers high, and the Earth perimeter is, I think, 24,000 kilometers, yeah? So that's negligible. But the changed normals result in these highlights. Yeah? So it really looks like there's this structure, but the fact that there is no real geometric displacement does not become visible at all. The only place where it becomes visible is along the silhouette. And here, in fact, I think if you closely look, you can still see that it's not even round, but you can still see the single faces, yeah, that it's straight lines here. And of course, if there's even if there would be a tall mountain, you would not see the silhouette changing, because the geometry that is rendered is still the triangles. Yeah? It's only for the lighting that these changed normals are taken, and that fake geometry. Okay, so yeah, that's the idea of normal maps. Yeah? So it's a very, very simple idea, but it's also very widely used and delivers nice effects. One minor thing that you have to consider is the following, that textures typically store 3D colors, RGB. Yeah? So if you read a texture, you get an RGB, or you get a triple of values between 0 and 1. And your normals typically should be values or should be in the range from minus 1 to 1. So there must be, this mapping must be applied to stretch the range from 0, 1 to minus 1. To one, yeah. So this is kind of encoding of such a normal map to a color map. That still has to happen. Okay, another example where this is used is shown here. So this is an original object. Yeah, this is very finely tessellated. Later on, we will see an image. So this has, I think, more than 100,000 triangles. In particular, these parts here, of course, there they are. Lots of geometry, very fine detailed geometry. Now, if you look at that thing from quite a distance, that's very wasteful. Yeah? And another thing that will happen, these very thin triangles, if you look at them from a larger distance, they will become so small that you get aliasing problems, aliasing in the first sense that we heard, that we have many triangles that are so small that they are not hit by the pixel sampling pattern. And this will also result in ugly effects. So it would be much better to replace this one by a coarsened version. So this one has much less triangles. In particular here, the geometry is replaced by something flat. So from a geometric point of view, this one is rather similar to this one. Yeah? So the distances between the objects are not very big. But of course, the visual appearance is very different. Yeah? A lot of detail gets lost from here to here. And even looking at it from a distance, you will notice the difference. Yeah? So what one could do is that, I will skip that one and come back to that one. Yeah. So here you see these triangles. So these are 115,000 triangles, these 800 triangles. So obviously, this is much faster to render than this one. Now, these are, again, such renderings. But what we could do is that we apply such a normal map. Yeah? And sorry, I have to wildly jump. This is what I wanted to have now. OK, and now we have this low polygon mesh and with a normal map applied. Yeah? And now this looks really very similar to that one, but this one has 850 triangles, and this has more than 100,000. And of course, if you get close, you will see at the silhouettes that there are differences and so on, but from a distance, they are really pretty similar. Okay. Good. So, yeah, how can we generate these normal maps? And yeah, that's typically not very complicated, or usually this can be done using tricks. So for instance, there is even in Photoshop or in GIMP, there are tools available that can take an arbitrary texture like this one, and then they make image processing operations to, for instance, get an image like this, which is an approximated height map. So what they do is just the darker a point is in general, the deeper it is assumed it is. Yeah. So if you have a cavity somewhere, then it's getting darker. So this can sort of be transformed to such a height map. So this really gives height values, and this can be translated to a normal map. Yeah. That's using computing derivatives, and then we get something like this here. This is really a map that for every point contains an estimate normal. Yeah, that is sort of related to this. And if we apply this to a planar surface, we get an image like that. Yeah, and this looks really like these stones get a little bit out, but at the silhouettes you see that it's still planar. Yeah, so that's simple by doing image processing. The other solution is, or another approach is, if you have this one, you have a very fine detailed model and a coarsened version. And now, of course, here, for every point, so we first have to apply a texture, and then for every point, look which point on this fine model is closest, and then copy the normal of that point. Yeah, so that we get the structure of this one into our texture here. That's exactly what happened in the example I saw later on. And there's one more thing that we have to take care of, and that's the following. So up to now, the objects that we put a texture on were a sphere or a cylinder or something like that. But if you have such a complex object, applying a texture is much more complicated. Yeah, because now we have that problem that we need to find a way to wrap a square texture onto such an object such that we don't have too much distortions or things like that. Yeah, so that's a difficult problem. I already spoke about that. And this is typically solved using something which we see here on the right, and we have even a better picture here. And that's what is called a texture atlas. So what that means is that the original object is split into several parts that are sort of planar. Yeah. So for instance, this box here, yeah, this is separated, and this can be even unfolded. Yeah. You see that box here. And now in our texture, so this is our entire texture, and now this part of the texture exactly describes this part of this box. Yeah, and the same is true for several other parts here. So the original object is decomposed into single parts that can be unfolded easily, and these single parts are then put together or puzzled together to fill such a texture. This is called a texture atlas. That's very often used. And it's typically necessary, yeah, for an object like that, or for more complicated objects. There are automatic tools to generate such atlases, but they definitely generate worse results than this here. So this is definitely an atlas that has been generated by hand, manually, with a lot of work. A lot of work has been spent, yeah, to generate such a nice texture atlas here. Okay. Good. So there's another issue that we have to take care of with normal maps, but this we will have to do then on Thursday. So we will see again on Thursday, and on Thursday it will again be 90 minutes, and then we compensated the one lecture from last time. So on Thursday again, 90 minutes. See you then.